Okay, so we'll get started. Now, last time we were having a quick look at quality of service support in the types of wireless networks that we've looked at so far. So from wireless LANs, Wi-Fi, to LTE-based systems, so cellular systems, to WiMAX. Point-to-point systems. Okay, and quality of service is based on the application requirements, which can typically be classified as, you know, their rate requirements. How much data do they have to send, and at what pace they have to send it? Loss tolerance: can they afford to lose data or not, or how much data can they afford to lose, and then delay and jitter tolerance. Okay. In terms of quality of service, we concentrated on the first link into the network, things like jitter. All of the factors are, end-to-end quantities, but we say that it's that first radio link that's likely to cause problems. And of course, for wireless systems, that's the link that we concentrate on. Okay. And so we noted that all of our systems are going to use adaptive modulation encoding. So depending on the quality of the channel, the data rate which you can push over that channel is going to change. Okay, and so obviously the... Is that right? Yet another quantity that our system is going to have to handle or take into account. So we noted that in both LTE and WiMAX, resource allocation was done in a centralized fashion. So you had some sort of controller that could calculate the resource allocation policies, and so users would essentially negotiate with the controller for the resources that they needed, again, with a focus on what data rates were necessary. Okay, and that works for both LTE and WiMAX, anything where, again, you have that idea of centralized control. We then noted that while there is a centralized control mode for Wi-Fi, in general, it's not the most common. Wi-Fi mainly uses a contention-based access mode. And we saw that we could still make some accounting for quality of service requirements for traffic within classes. And so the EDCA mechanism is going to define a number of classes and then assign essentially priorities and transmission opportunities to those classes, so that depending on your class, you will get more or less access to the medium. Okay, so we're going to finish off the course material today with sort of one last discussion of roughly what can be under the heading of mobile ad hoc networking. And this is the idea now that nodes are going to organize to form sort of not just point-to-point connections, but multi-hop connections and cooperate to get data across multiple hops. And as you might suspect, sort of one of the key issues here is going to be the routing. And probably discuss that as we go along. Okay, so all of the networks we've looked at so far, we have a single wireless hop to and some sort of access point, whether that's a base station or just into the LAN access point. Okay. And so, again, if that's the case, the focus is just on that wireless, that one wireless link, and we try and optimize, again, the qualities of that single wireless link. Okay. So we're now going to sort of toss everything out the window and consider mobile ad hoc networks. And so, as I said, nodes arrange to provide routing over multiple wireless links. And so if that's not enough, the nodes may be mobile, so they may themselves be moving around, so you don't have a fixed architecture or fixed topology for your network. And if that's not enough, potentially the nodes may be either processing or power constrained. Okay, so they might not be plugged into a wall anywhere or have access to sort of big batteries, and they may be indeed very small and don't have much of anything. Okay. So, people started out thinking about these and sort of looking for a unified solution to the problems, or what's the ideal way to implement this sort of network, and quickly realized that, there's sort of too many parameters. And when you started thinking about, what would these networks be used for, various of these parameters would be sort of more or less important. Okay, and depending on exactly the type of system you got, the solution that you would want to for implementation would then be different. Okay, so we can consider a number of subclasses, this general class. Say a bit about wireless mesh networks. And so they're sort of infrastructure lights. They're, you can think of them as providing, access over sort of relatively small areas, and being able to do this sort of on an on-demand basis. So if you have a concert or something temporary, you can set one of these networks up to fulfill a sort of temporary demand. So they'll have one set of characteristics. We'll go through the characteristics in a minute. Wireless sensor networks. Okay, so again, the key components of those are the sensors, which again are going to be small, maybe you know, attached to farm animals or herds of wild animals that may be moving, and again, our oat powder and processing constrained. Mobile ad hoc networks, I threw that one in, so again, relatively temporary communication networks where we don't have the option of setting up this sort of infrastructure, even a light infrastructure. Okay, and it's the sort of two usual examples of that are military. So if you're on the battlefield, how do you set up a communication network? Or sometimes now social. You have groups congregating together for a concert or whatever, then possibly they could form networks. Okay, and finally, sort of an emerging area, vehicular ad hoc networks. And here you have cars, which, because of their nature, have processing power, have processors, have a lot of serious electronics these days, can also have wireless radio equipment, GPS equipment, etc., and don't have the power constraints of some of these other systems because the car has an unlimited source of power, more or less. Okay, so wireless mesh networks are probably the closest to what we've been discussing so far, or the closest maybe to traditional networks in the sense that they really are designed to provide radio access to end users, again, over a relatively limited space, and on a temporary basis. Okay. And so the idea is that if you need additional networking power, because you know that there's going to be a lot of people in an area for a game, a concert, a convention, then you can set up a wireless network, giving people access to ultimately the internet. And so the main difference from conventional networks, again, is the fact that this setup tends to be temporary, and the links through the mesh are wireless. Okay, so it's not wired links. Okay. Mesh, the routers, so the access points for this sort of network, we can assume have a power source, so they're not particularly, don't have any particular power limitations. Typically we assume that they're stationary, so you arrange it in some sort of optimal fashion, but then you leave it alone. Okay. And they have good computational power. Again, this is the power source, and the processing power is not that expensive anymore. Okay. So they do fall into this multi-hop wireless framework, and again, the main issues with these tends to be just the quality of the links, but they are not sort of overly complicated to deal with in the sense that, you arrange the setup initially in some hopefully optimal fashion, and then it's not going to change. Okay, so they're relatively well behaved and
therefore we won't worry about them too much. Wireless sensor networks are sort of at the extreme opposite end of that. Our nodes are going to be either sensors or data aggregators. And so we assume that the sensors are numerous, battery operated, possibly highly mobile. Okay, so again, here, this is tracking herds of deer, and so each deer has a sensor, and you can't tell the deer to stand still. And because they're small and battery operated, they have low computational power. Typically, the setup for a sensor network is that data will be relayed from node to node. Without processing, but it will eventually be relayed to some sort of data aggregator where processing can occur and the data can be forwarded, again, to a remote location, like the internet. So, again, the sensors themselves are really pathological. The data aggregators less so, and they may or may not be battery-based. They're assumed to be less mobile, have more computational power, etc. Okay, so if you think about the sensor end of things, again, that's sort of as bad as it gets in terms of trying to form a network. Okay. And so, like, somewhere in the middle, possibly, are just sort of general ad hoc networks where we're using them, again, to set up communication over relatively short distances. You might do that for collaborative computing, again, just social reasons to connect up, say, everybody at a concert. Disaster recovery if your infrastructure has taken a hit, or, you know, again, military applications. Okay. So we assume the nodes are a little bit more sophisticated than the sensors, so that people think of either a computer or a smartphone. They may or may not have unlimited power. They have good computational power, but again, if they're battery operated, we have to try and possibly conserve that computational power. The more you compute, the faster you run down your battery. And so the nodes have to cooperate to share the information over the wireless links. And the networks can vary in size and mobility. Okay, and the final example is vehicular ad hoc networks. Okay, and so again, these are used for transmitting any sort of information that would be useful while you're driving. And so that can be emergency messaging. So if you have a crash, the car can essentially send out an SOS message, and everybody can, again, take action to avoid the crash. That can be used for traffic management, so to try and route vehicles around crashes or around just bottlenecks in traffic. And people have even proposed that they can be used for entertainment purposes. So if you have a bunch of cars
together, then possibly you can use them to stream your videos. Typically, VANET communication either occurs from car to car to car, and you can do so in a multi-hop fashion, or we can also have access to roadside units, and then those can either be sort of standalone, or nowadays they sort of bundle them with like traffic lights. Okay. And so information occurs both car to car or to roadside units, which would the roadside unit then would have access back into the network and could be used again to calculate traffic management policies, etc., or to propagate emergency messages farther back through the road network. Okay. So here the vehicles are assumed to have processors, radios, and possibly GPS, well, definitely GPS, so that we know their location. So the nice thing about that is that you know the topology of the network that you can form. They have high processing capabilities and no power constraints. Again, because, well, cars, we can assume that car has sort of unlimited power for this sort of operation. But the topology obviously is changing. So the cars are on the move. There's no sense of assuming that there's any stationarity. There's some regularity to the topology in the sense that cars do go one after the other as they travel down the road, but cars can enter and exit any road segment, so there are changes to the topology of the network. Okay, so what we're going to do is just look at primarily the routing issue, how we've seen now how the problem changes, how the problem differs from a wired setup, in that we have unreliable channels, we have multiple unreliable channels. The more hops you make, sort of, the more the reliability degrades. You have mobility leading to, again, changes in topology. You don't have a centralized controller, which actually arguably is similar to the wired system where the policies are calculated in a decentralized fashion. But you may not have a whole pile of processing power to make these calculations. Okay, so there's a whole lot of problems that certainly become more difficult to deal with in this context. Medium access control is an issue. So typically these networks are set up using sort of either Wi-Fi or maybe personal area networks, so even shorter range contention-based protocols. And so if you have multiple hops over those contention-based protocols, you're
are having even more problems than we have this, you know, but set up similar to our hidden and exposed node problems. Okay. Routing becomes difficult because the topology is potentially changing rapidly. Quality of service is more difficult to maintain because you're not going over, again, multiple wireless links. It's hard to predict exactly how you're going to traverse the network. And so you have the issues associated with single links, and then and the more links you traverse, the more those problems are evident. Power savings can be an issue or not. And again, since this is a completely wireless setup, security is also an issue. Again, there's a lot of work done about security issues. We aren't going to talk about it here, but again, you're not just protecting a single wireless link, but you have to sort of protect everyone within the network.
Okay, so again, we're going to pick out the single issue of routing, and primarily just look at, again, I don't think there's no one, again, uniform solution. There's a lot of solutions have been proposed, or still being proposed, but we'll just look at sort of what the sort of general approach is, the possible ways in which you can approach the problem of determining a route, a multi-hop path through these networks. Okay, so we'll start by just reviewing what the wired routing protocols do. Okay, so you would have seen these in EE224. And we'll just remind you of what the sort of philosophy behind those is. I won't go into the details of how the paths are calculated. Okay, so for wired routing, the goal is to find the least cost path between sender and receiver. And again, remember that the topology of these networks is reasonably static. Links can die, possibly if cost is factoring in any sort of congestion, that can change. But the time frame over which it changes is assumed to be relatively slow. And so we would like the whatever. Algorithm we use to determine the least cost to obviously will be correct, simple, and efficient. It should be robust, so it should be able to respond to changes within the network. It should be stable, so there aren't changes, or the changes are not significant. It shouldn't be wildly varying in terms of that. Does. We want it to be fair, so all users should get roughly equal access, and we should have some concept of optimality. But again, the question is optimal with respect to what. Okay.
we can think of the simplest case, which is just
optimal in that it'll find the shortest path through the network. Okay, so if the costs of the network links are known,
then we can, routers can run the algorithm to determine the best routes from the sender to receiver. In practice, we want that those solutions to be adaptive, so if we can't just run it at the beginning and assume that nothing is changing, so we need to account for changes. And we also want to do this in a decentralized fashion. Okay, so the network is too big and complicated to have a central decision point. Okay, so each router is, the routers cooperate to exchange sufficient information to allow each router then to make the appropriate decision. Okay. So the nodes have to exchange some information about the network with each other. And so again, we saw that there were two basic ways in which we could do this link state routing and then distance vector routing. Okay, so I should really flip those away. Okay, so distance vector routing, the nodes communicate solely with their neighbors, but they give information about the entire network, their view of the entire network. Link state nodes communicate with the entire network, but they only send information about their nearest neighbors. Okay. So again, I'm sure you've seen this slide more or less before, and we can think that each router is going to have a number of neighbors which they can reach over a single link. We think of the cost as being to transmit to the link, not to remove data from the link, but again, since we're not actually going to calculate cost, it doesn't matter that much. So the routers, what the routers need to do is to somehow build up a picture of this network and what the costs, what the topology is and what the costs are. Okay. And so based on their picture of the network, then they'll decide what the next node,
to forward the forward the information to is. Okay, and so we assume that if the node has some complete picture of the network, then it can use that complete picture to determine, again, the paths, the least cost paths through the network. And so now, how does the node build up the picture of the network? Well, again, it has to share information with other nodes in the network. Okay, so they have to share their knowledge of the network. Okay, so the original algorithm proposed was the distance vector routing algorithm. And here, any node has sort of tries to build up the picture of the network, and periodically it shares its picture of the network with the neighboring nodes. Okay. So it sends potentially a fair amount of information, but over a single hop. So if you're not a neighbor, then it's going to, again, take longer for any given node's information to propagate to you. Okay. So A, again, has a picture of the network. It sends that picture to B along one cycle. Okay, and so B will sort of integrate what it knows and what A knows. The next cycle, B propagates its picture to C, and therefore C now knows what B knows, but also what A knows, or what A knew one cycle back. So eventually, the information propagates through the network. Again, if things aren't changing rapidly, but relatively slow, propagation can be just fine. Okay. Okay, so this was, again, the original ARPANET and the early internet routing protocol, but sort of as things got bigger, a few problems emerged. So you could potentially get loops in the transmission of data, and packets, and it would also, the bigger the network, the slower it is to converge, because the slower, obviously, it is for everyone to get that view of the network. Okay. Along the same lines, it's slow to react to events, because, again, everything only propagates one hop at a time. So attempts to solve these problems led to the proposal of the second algorithm, the link state routing algorithm. Okay, so distance vector, a node sends lots of information, their whole view of the network, but only to the neighbors. Now, with linked state, nodes send smaller amounts of information. So they send information about just their neighbors, so what neighbors they can reach and what the cost of reaching those neighbors is. But they send it to the whole network. Okay. So you have a small amount of information, but it's flooding the network. How often this happens depends on changes to network conditions. Obviously, you only send information when something has changed. Hopefully this is not happening extremely often, and too much information is going to. If the changes happen too frequently, then you just end up flooding the network with these updates. Information is going to reach the nodes faster. So again, if something changes, you're not waiting from cycle to cycle for that change to propagate through the network, but rather it's sent through the network immediately. Okay. In this way, again, each node has a complete view of what's happening in the network, and then they can use that to compute make their path cost calculations. And so you use something like Dijkstra's algorithm to compute the shortest path to every other node. The computations made are, the Dijkstra's algorithm would be more computationally intensive than would the merging of information that was used for distance vector editing. Okay. So in our sort of classic network context, the link state routing algorithms have good properties. They converge rapidly. They don't generate a large amount of traffic, and yet you can have rapid response to changes within the network. Okay. And this class of routers routing algorithms is used currently in the internet. Again, if the topology is changing rapidly, then you can generate significant traffic within the network.
Okay. So one final note on our sort of classic routing protocols,
and that's that internet, it's not a flat topology. We have sort of it's too big an entity overall to just for everyone to sort of keep a complete view of the entire world, but it's divided into regions, okay? And the regions are referred to as autonomous systems, and then between autonomous systems there are gateways, and so you can move from one autonomous system to the next through the gateways. And so within an autonomous system, you use what's called an interior gateway protocol. OSPF is the typical one you use. And again, that follows this link state routing protocol. And then between autonomous systems, you use a border gateway protocol. So you decide, again, from one autonomous system to the next. And so the gateways exchange information, and again, using link state routing. And so you can go from one autonomous system to the next. Okay, so essentially the idea here is to limit the size of the network over which you're
having to calculate these routes. Okay, so
we still have multi-hop networks in our ad hoc mobile scenario, but now potentially they're not very well behaved at all. So our topology changes obviously with mobility, since our links are wireless, the quality of those links is obviously changing with mobility, and we can't even assume necessarily that we have communication in both directions. The routers, the nodes, may be limited in energy and computational ability. So we have to place some priority on keeping our protocols simple, and also on sort of exchanging as little information as necessary. Because the transmission of messaging, again, impacts the ability of the network to carry data and also consumes energy. If you want to keep things sort of simple and low computational complexity, scalability then becomes an issue. So the bigger the network, the harder it is to achieve that. And again, the quality of the links can be changing rapidly. Okay, so the routing protocols used we can classify them along two factors. First of all, we can think about how they react to topology, and so there are suggestions assuming sort of a flat topology, and there are also hierarchical routing suggestions as well, where nodes are grouped either sort of by proximity, or the algorithm potentially varies depending on sort of the distance of one node to another. The other big way in which the protocols are going to differ, again, is just how the information is updated. Okay. And so typically we have either proactive or reactive schemes. And with a proactive scheme, the proactive is certain types of protocols we've been discussing, where the nodes try and keep a complete view of the network, as accurate a view as possible. Reactive schemes are sort of the reverse. The view is thinking, well, what's the point in sort of doing all this work to sort of keep a picture of the network? So we're having to compute, we're having to sort of exchange lots of messages to get our topology, then we're having to run an algorithm to compute routes based on that topology. Then the topology is just changing on us. So what's the point? Instead, maybe I can just try and figure out routes when somebody actually needs them. So reacting to the incoming traffic. And of course, it's possible to maintain some halfway house between those two. For instance, if we are using the reactive system, we can also use the information we gave to try and update our topology, etc. Or again, just based on something hierarchical, we may use either a proactive or a reactive scheme. Okay, so again, proactive scheme. We try and calculate, or a node will try and calculate the routes to all destinations, sort of at the start. And the routes are maintained by a periodic update process. And again, if the topology is changing rapidly, then we're going to have a big overhead, both in terms of message exchange and computation. On-demand or reactive routing schemes determine the routes when needed using a route discovery procedure. And obviously that cuts down on our computation, but if you have to determine a route before you can forward on a packet, then this may cause delays in the transmission of the packets, and even having determined a route, it's not necessarily the case that the routes are stable. So you do this work to find an end-to-end route, but by the time you've sent your packet along it, something has changed. And so then hybrid would try and combine some proactive and reactive elements. Okay, so just looking first at our proactive routing protocols. Again, this is our table-driven approach, where each node is trying to maintain the best picture of the network that's possible and calculate the routes according to that picture. Okay. Obviously, nodes have to communicate with each other to sort of update and communicate exchanges. Again, we're going to assume now that that is happening more frequently than it would have in our wired scenario. Okay, so both distance vector routing and link state routing, their protocols based on both distance vector and link state routing. With respect to distance vector routing, we have wireless routing protocol and destination sequence distance vector, DSDV. And the reason that distance vector has entered back into the picture is because the messaging, the data sent, does not have to travel long distances. And we're just talking to our immediate neighbors. And as we also noted, the maintenance of our tables is less computationally complex than it was for link state routing. And so both of those factors may be important in our networks. So it's possible they do present some modifications to try and sort of make it optimize for our wireless scenarios. And first of all, information can be sent when changes are detected, as opposed to before, where we sent them just periodically. So again, if things are changing more rapidly, this will allow the changes to propagate faster. We can also just send partial, we don't have to send all of our information. We can send is just partial tables, possibly just with the updated information. So there's also attempts to assess the currency of the information, because again, if you assume things are changing, then if you think the information you got is sort of old and out of date, you don't necessarily want to act upon it. Okay. And so typically now, some information is given about the age of the updates, and nodes are more likely to act upon more current updates. Okay, and it can also, so again, it also tries other tricks to improve the dissemination of information. Okay, so that works pretty well for relatively small networks, but as the network grows in size, it has the same sort of performance issues that it would have previously. Yeah. Okay. So, link state routing is also used, and so a couple of more common versions are OLSR, optimized link state routing, and fisheye state routing. Okay. And the main change in OLSR is just it tries to improve the reliability of the update process. So, the drawbacks are just, again, the cost to the network in exchanging the information. So, again, now we're flooding the network with our change information, and that might be quite costly in a wireless context. And again, the computations, running the Dijkstra's algorithm that's required by the nodes is more expensive than the merging of tables for distance vector routing. So, again, if you're constrained in an energy or a computational sense, then that can be problematic. So fisheye state routing gives us an example of using a hierarchical scheme to try and reduce some of those problems, in particular the reduce the amount of information that has to be exchanged. So try and lessen the overhead on the network from information exchange. Okay, and so the way it does this is that the amount of information that's propagated depends on the distance of that information from the source. And so we assume that the nodes are periodically updating their neighbors, but those updates will be more frequent nodes are periodically updating everybody, but the updates will be more frequent to nearer nodes. Okay. With the assumption that what you need is, it's best, it's good to have a very accurate local picture, but often the data is not going to be transmitted over a large number of hops. So if you can keep an accurate picture over a small number of hops, you'll actually cater for a good bit of of your data traffic. And then some of the data obviously will travel farther, and so you want to keep some picture of what's going on farther. But it doesn't necessarily need to be quite as accurate. Okay. So the bottom line for proactive writing is that there's a scalability issue in terms of wireless networks are sensitive to traffic loads, so if you're sending a lot of update information, that can be a problem in and of itself. Computationally, it might be easier or harder to run the algorithms. And so we often see some sort of trade-off between the accuracy and the control overhead. Reactive routing tries to minimize the overhead by only determining the routes as they're needed. So if all of the traffic is sort of going in one direction, well, you only really need one route to do that stream of traffic. And so, again, there's a number of proposals for reactive protocols. One of the most common is the dynamic source routing protocol. And here, data packets carry routing information, okay, and the nodes then can cache this information. So when a packet needs to be sent, the sending node can look and see if information is already cached. If it is, great. If not, then it goes into a process of route discovery. And essentially, this is just asking successive nodes whether they know a route to the destination, whether a route is maintained in those nodes' caches. So the packet sends to all its neighboring nodes the query asking if it has a route. And so if the node doesn't have a route, it appends its address. Again, we're building up the route. And then forwards the query onto its neighbors. And finally, after sort of a number of appended queries, somebody will either hit the destination, or somebody will know of a route, and they will generate a reply packet with the route information. Yeah, it might be difficult for the reply packets to return to the source due to the asymmetric links, but as a basic case, we can sort of assume that once the route's been discovered, we can return that information to our node, and again, they'll forward that along. They again forward along in the reverse direction, and so all of the nodes along that path can then cache that information.
Okay. So,
the nodes end up maintaining sort of partial pictures of routes through the network, and also there's some question about sort of what's the optimality of the path that's chosen. You know, basically, the main thing you can say is it's based on response times, so potentially
that means that it is the shortest path.
Okay, so AODV is another fairly common version, and here the information that's kept is in the form of a next hop routing table. So again, if you want to go to a certain destination, and send it along that next hop, you're assuming that a full path exists.
It's good. So at some point in the past, it did exist.
Okay. And so the table, the entries to the table will expire if they're not used or reactivated for within a fixed amount of time. Okay, so the assumption is that things are changing. So if it's been too long since you decided this was the best way to go, you better try and decide, make a decision, a new decision. Okay, and so again, if a node wants to send a packet for which no route entry exists, it uses a route discovery path procedure, so it sends out a route request packet, and so that packet will then filter through the network with information being appended, and upon the return, all the nodes in the network can try and update their tables based on the response to the request packet. If nodes disappear entirely, then the neighboring nodes will inform the network of this as well.
Okay.
Okay, so there are, again, lots of algorithms, other algorithms exist. Tora, does seek to, again, build up a complete picture of the network, but if does this sort of on the fly and hopefully in an efficient fashion, and we'll try and maintain multiple paths from source to destination, and if there are changes, then it tries to erase faulty routes, and again tests when packets are sent, seeks to test the accuracy of its model. Okay, so again, the bottom line: the reactive routing can reduce the signaling overhead and potentially the processing overhead experienced in the network, but again, you can, if there's some delay while you're determining your routes, the routes potentially may change in the space of time it takes to get the information about them. And you know, it's, in general, you're not going to find an optimal route through the network. Okay, so again, we can try to tackle our problem in a hierarchical fashion, again by typically routing, having the different routing protocols apply, sort of if you're close to geographically or hop count wise relatively close to your destination, or whether you're farther away. Okay. And again, the protocols are tied to the topology of the network, where again you're trying to group networks that are close to each other and treat them in one way, and then if you have to go farther afield, try a different approach. Okay. So, sort of typical to, similar to the way we said that within the wired network we had a hierarchy and nodes had a different functionality. Here, hierarchical protocols, again, usually distinguish node functionality, with some nodes having more functionality and greater responsibility than others. And a few examples of hierarchical routing protocols are zone-based clustering and core-based. And again, for each of these, you'll define some nodes which will act as gateways for the network. Okay, so with zone-based routing protocols, the network is divided into zones. And the division can be based on either a physical location or, again, the number of hop counts. Okay, so you can use either to sort of find what's close and what's far away. Within a zone, proactive routing can be used. Okay, so the nodes know how to maintain a complete picture of routing within the zone and the topology within the zone. Okay. Because we're restricting the size, the scaling issues don't come into play. Between zones, you can either use a reactive or proactive protocol. And so, again, this would typically depend on what scale, and again, you calculate the route from zone to zone to zone and have some sort of gateway between the zones. Okay, so we have a somewhat similar idea with cluster-based routing protocols. Here, a cluster head is defined, and fulfills fulfills the role of almost a centralized controller.
And so a cluster is defined as all the nodes within range of a cluster head. And then the cluster head will maintain routing within the cluster. Gateway nodes are used to move from one cluster to the next. So a gateway node has to be within overlapping clusters. And so the cluster head can know how which gateway to send the information through. Again, the problem with this sort of a protocol is that if they are highly mobile, it's hard to maintain these clusters, and it's hard to maintain connectivity between the clusters. Another similar proposal is core-based routing. And here, again, nodes are distinguished to form a backbone through which data can flow. And typically, it's assumed that these core nodes are more stable in terms of energy and mobility. And so we can think of this more like the scenario for our wireless mesh network. There we go. A network which is fairly well behaved, and then it provides connectivity for less well behaved nodes. Okay. So, again, the bottom line here. Is that we can use the hierarchical routing to reduce communication and computational overheads, but at the cost of having sort of additional effort possibly to maintain whatever form of hierarchy. That effort sort of can be more or less depending on, again, the mobility and the amount of change within the network. So, again, if you're interested in reading about any of this, this reference talks about this and more routing protocols. Okay, so, like I said, that's it for the material for the course. I guess you still have to do your second assignment. Just a few words on the exam. And just to let you know my view on it. So, pretty much all of the material is examinable. Having said that, I don't explicitly ask you anything about NS3 or the assignments that you've done, and I don't explicitly ask you anything about the introduction lecture. So everything else is fair game. So the comm system model, the RF link, spread spectrum, all of our cellular topics. Medium access control, so LAN, network, cellular network implementation. I think should add quality of service there. I forgot something. Okay, so everything except these two. So where do I draw questions from? We have the lecture notes, and if you're feeling masochistic, we have Camtasia recordings of all the lecture notes. We have a couple of problem sets.
And what I always say is that these are indicative of the general style and type of problem that can be asked. I can always sort of find a slightly different way to ask the same thing. I can always change the numbers, etc. But, you know, if you're comfortable doing these sorts of problems, then you should be comfortable doing the type of problems that arise on the exams.
Okay, so since I left it in there, I do have an old sample exam.
But the main thing you might get out of that is just, again, the indicative solutions. All old exam papers are available on the registry website. And again, you'll see that the format is fairly standard and the general type of question is fairly standard, so you should get an idea of types of questions asked. You still have choice, so you have to answer 4 out of 5 questions. Okay.
And so, you know, again, if you look at the exams, you'll see that there's
a sort of, there's only certain types of questions can be asked. I might ask you to do derivations from the notes, calculations, and again, these will be similar to the tutorial problem sets, and finally, general knowledge, facts about how different things are set up, etc. Try not to do too much data mining on the questions. you may or may not be disappointed if you do. So, I'm available if you have any questions. Just send me an email. I'll either meet with you or address the questions electronically.
Is that document available on Loop?
Yeah, although I'm just going to often change a few bits of it. But yes, this is all on Loop. So everything I mention in here, the document itself, should be on Loop. If you think there's something missing, it was probably hidden or something, so please do send me email and I'll sort it out.
Some slides, there's nothing updated in Loop.
Sorry?
Some slides from the last lecture, it's not updated in the Loop. So there's some slides not available.
It should be.
Okay, well, let me take that offline. I'll just finish my recording.